Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, November 9th, 2020. Coming up, I'll have news about the wind down of the Peter B. Collins podcast. And we'll pay tribute to Bones Hillman and to America's favorite game show host, Alex Trebek. Both died over the weekend. But the big news, of course, is that Saturday morning, as Donald Trump was heading out to the golf course, led by CNN, the television networks decided that they had enough votes to make the call that Joe Biden has secured victory through the Electoral College. It was Pennsylvania and Nevada who put him over the top. And while there still is the potential for post-election mischief from the Trump team, so far, I don't see a path to getting a case before the Supreme Court that could overturn enough votes to turn the tide back in Trump's favor. Now, my fingers are crossed as I say that, because we cannot expect that the unexpected won't occur. And I have been warning my friends, fans, and listeners here for months that we have not yet seen bottom. I stand by that. We've seen a lot of sludge flow through the sewers, but I'm not sure that we have actually seen bottom. And I want to share the joy, the elation that many rank-and-file Democrats feel. Joe Biden is not perfect by any means or for really any particular perspective inside the party. And I didn't vote for Joe Biden. But I welcome this sequence of events with great, great relief. And the future is going to be very difficult. Trump has created a huge mess, not only in Washington, but worldwide. And with the very narrow election of the Biden-Harris team, without taking control of the Senate, and even if the gods from Georgia, which appears to be a state that will be put into Biden's column eventually, the two Senate seats that are up for runoff on January 5th are expected to leave a Senate that is at 51 or possibly 52 for the Republicans. And that means that the Senate's chief obstructionist, Mitch McConnell, will be there to obstruct Biden the way he did Obama. And it's not that Joe Biden had any great progressive grand dreams or schemes. He's an incrementalist, corporate Democrat, pro-war, who I think has grown in this campaign. The guy who wrote some of the worst criminal laws in the 1990s, the guy who opposed busing and embraced segregationists when he first came to the Senate in the 1970s, I think he has evolved in some ways. When he gave his victory speech to a parking lot of cars in Wilmington, Delaware, on Saturday night, he articulated his four priorities: COVID, the economy, systemic racism. Now I can't remember the fourth. But the fact that he mentioned racism is not just a nod to the African-American voters who came out in big numbers for Biden, both in the primary and in this general election. But I believe it's his way of signaling that he has learned at least something from this experience. And fundamentally, I give the Democrats credit for running a campaign that I felt was too safe. I felt that Obama came out way too late to enter the fray. There are so many missed opportunities, it's hard to recall or recount them all. but they overcame the incredible obstacles that were erected by the Republicans. All that voter suppression, all of the gamesmanship. This was a remarkable effort by the Republicans to stop people from voting, and if they did, to stop their ballots from being counted. And while the popular vote is likely to be about 76 to 71 million votes, that does show a clear preference for the Democratic ticket. But it leaves us with 71 million Trump voters who have been seduced, who have been indoctrinated and propagandized into a cult that will live long after Trump, hopefully, exits the White House without armed persuasion. And as Biden sends what I think are appropriate signals, trying to heal the divide in America, trying to signal that he wants to be president of all Americans, not just one party the way Trump did it. He is hoping to, you know, look beyond just his base. But my biggest fear right now is that Joe Biden is heading down the same failed path that Barack Obama did in his first term. Believing that Washington can be healed, that we can kumbaya, and we can face the flag and recite that pledge of allegiance, whether we take a knee or not. That we'll just kind of, you know, develop a kind of common amnesia. Let's just forget about the last 4 years. Well, it's a nice sentiment. But I can't embrace it. Maybe it's the cynical old dog that I've become. But there is no signal from the core of the Republican Party that they're ready to jettison Trump, flush twice, and call it a new day. They're still painting the Democrats as radical, liberal, socialist, communist, and dangerous to America. So, I will support Biden's play toward bipartisanship as soon as he gets a significant buy-in from a major Republican. And what this means, with the pressing needs of the economy, with COVID, Joe Biden's going to be treading water. With the divided Congress, there's no hope to, whether you call it pack the court or expand the court, nothing's going to happen there. He'll be lucky to get a reasonable, what the Republicans call stimulus package, what I call relief or bailout money, in the lame duck session. And after that, Mitch is probably just going to cut off the flow. He doesn't mind if millions of Americans get evicted, become homeless, or even get sick without health insurance, if it advances his desperate partisan vision. And on his side, Joe Biden has a mandate, but he didn't run on anything that he could say, well, you know, I said I'm going to do X, Y, Z, you elected me, and now here comes X, Y, and Z. And so I don't believe that we're going to see anything close to Medicare for all. They're afraid of the term Green New Deal. It's too socialist, too lefty. So I think that on an incremental basis, Biden will address climate change. But it will not measure up to the crisis that we face. And his whole tendency, when he confronts the gridlock of the Congress, is to imagine that Joe Biden can reach across the aisle, as he did so many times over the years, But when he makes that reach, I think he'll get a fist, not a hand. And so already, we have heard rumors from Washington that Mitt Romney has been offered the cabinet post at Health and Human Services. Why? Because RomneyCare was the model for the failed Obamacare, which may be taken down by the courts. The oral arguments are scheduled for tomorrow at the Supreme Court. And if Obamacare is found unconstitutional or defective for any reason by SCOTUS, there's almost no route to passage of a replacement. And so, number one, we saw Obama attempt to put a Republican in his cabinet. What was that guy's name? Judd Gregg, a senator from New Hampshire, who accepted. Then, I guess, in the steam room in the Senate gym, he got burned, and he withdrew. And that was the first signal that Obama failed to grasp as he kept negotiating with himself over the health care reform that became the American, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. Yeah, that's what it stands for. And Obama didn't really change his tune until he lost control of the Senate in 2010. Then there's John Kasich. And he's a complicated guy, all right? He's from Ohio, where I grew up. He calls himself a moderate Republican, but he's very extreme on being anti-abortion. He is a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist. And it's not even clear what job Biden has in mind for John Kasich. But he spoke at the convention from the crossroads in Xenia, Ohio, or wherever the hell that was. And so Joe thinks that, well, put me a couple of Republicans into the cabinet, and then they'll be doing that reaching across the aisle so we can unify the country. But John Kasich and Mitt Romney have very few friends in Washington in today's Republican Party. They don't have the juice. They don't have the leverage. And anyone who did is, you know, somebody with the Trump virus who is not going to work in the best interests of the nation or do anything that would make the Biden administration look good. And so, yes, I am deeply relieved. I feel better now heading into retirement, as it appears that Trump will be ejected from the White House. That's a very good thing. It's it's healthy for our country. But I can't get excited about the prospects for this incoming administration, which starts off by saying, we're moderate, don't expect too much. Biden told Wall Street, nothing important is going to change. And I think we can take him at his word. Then I mentioned McConnell in my San Francisco Chronicle over the weekend. Bob Agelko, who's a great legal affairs writer, wrote that McConnell has already signaled that Senate Republicans would be willing to consider centrist choices for Biden's cabinet, but would reject any radical progressives. Now, once again, this is not some return to the old status quo. Because for generations, as I've been watching Washington since the Nixon administration, a new administration is given wide latitude, and basically they rubber stamp the incoming cabinet in deference to the president and the voters. And unless somebody is deeply flawed, like John Tower of Texas, when they wanted to make him defense secretary, he brought Jack Daniels with him, and even his fellow Republicans didn't think that that was a wise move. But McConnell is signaling that it's about politics. You can't let any libtards get put into the Democratic cabinet. And Biden will accept that, and Biden will work with that, and he won't, provoke Mitch by nominating an Elizabeth Warren or anybody who could remotely be called out as a progressive. So Biden has sent one good signal that I fully applaud. He wants to bring an end to America First, the slogan that Trump used with echoes from the Lindbergh era. He also says that he is prepared to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal, assuming that the Iranians will observe its limits. He would sign up for another 5 years of the only surviving nuclear arms treaty with Russia. He also says he wants to make Russia pay a price for disruptions and attempts to influence elections. Not sure how he'll straddle that. He also says he'll return to the Paris Climate Accord. I'm certainly in favor of that. But how will he then negotiate with a Republican-controlled Senate and a narrowly controlled Democratic House to pass any meaningful carbon reduction legislation? So it's fascinating, because I'm going to get to a list of the enablers of Trump who have not given up. But one of the signals that reasonable people accept the designation of Biden and Harris as the winners is the world leaders who have sent congratulations, like Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel. And she offered warm comments about Joe Biden and noted Kamala Harris's gender, like herself, said she's looking forward to getting to know her. Saudi Arabia. Oh, yeah, our good friends in the House of Saud. Well, the King and Crown Prince MBS, who had just finished washing his hands, but the blood is never coming off, they both sent messages congratulating Biden on his electoral victory. And it'll be very interesting to see how Biden navigates the Saudis and the Israelis. And there's an interesting message that comes from Benjamin Netanyahu. And this is in the voice of the New York Times, which is staunchly pro-Netanyahu and pro-Israel. They refer to Trump's defeat as the end. It puts Netanyahu on the receiving end of an abrupt demotion, is how they characterize it. Overnight, Biden's victory, they say, effectively downgraded Israel's ranking on the list of U.S. foreign policy priorities, diminishing Netanyahu's stature on the global stage and undercutting his argument to restive Israeli voters that he remains their indispensable leader. But Netanyahu apparently squirmed as he first waited 12 hours to offer perfunctory congratulations on Twitter to Biden, just saying congratulations on your victory, not mentioning that he had won the presidency. That was almost immediately followed by an effusive expression of gratitude to Trump. So the ass-kissing continues. And, of course, the tension here is that, as I mentioned, Biden has talked about returning to the six-nation deal related to Iran's nuclear intentions. And that, of course, really pisses Bibi off. And the Times puts it this way: in contrast to Trump's favoritism toward Israel, Biden has promised to return to a more balanced approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, as it relates to Iran, that is true. But frankly, every Democrat is so captive to Israel. Kamala Harris has proclaimed her loyalty to Israel, her deep devotion. And so I think this will be a very interesting set of issues. I'm very curious to see how Biden deals with them. But Vladimir Putin has declined so far to congratulate Mr. Biden. His spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said, "We believe it would be proper to wait for an official announcement. There are certain legal procedures pending that were announced by the current president." Peskov sought to couch the delay as a technical matter of diplomatic protocol, saying that Putin would be ready to work with any elected president of the United States. Maybe it's because of the bromance that Putin does not want to break Donald Trump's heart. He just wants to bust his balls. And, of course, the Times has it in for Russian media. The article says, in unison, Russian officials and state-controlled media echoed Trump's depiction of the election as riddled with widespread fraud. On the flagship weekly news program on state TV Sunday night, the host said the election showed the United States to be not a country, but a huge chaotic communal apartment with a criminal flair. That's a very interesting way of describing my country. Oh, and by the way, Susan Collins of Maine, along with Mitt Romney, appear to be the only two Republicans so far who have congratulated Joe Biden. And in doing so, they are sending a message to Trump that he needs to get real and end the reality drama that he continues to live in. That's where he is. So, interestingly, the Washington Post wrote a piece about the love affair between Fox News and Trump may be over. And Fox News was the last to declare Biden the victor 16 minutes after CNN did on Saturday morning. But before we get to that, today, there was an unusual development on a live feed on Fox News. Neil Cavuto was the anchor, and they had joined a press conference being hosted by White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, who was there with RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel. And remember, she is the niece of Mitt Romney. So Cavuto decided to abruptly cut away because there was a pack of lies streaming from McEnany's mouth. She accused Democrats of opposing basic safeguards that verify voter eligibility, even though every jurisdiction in the U.S. verifies that voters are authorized to cast a ballot. She also said the Democrats are trying to keep observers out of the count room, even though Democratic and Republican observers have been allowed in most election offices across the country. And that's hardly a definitive issue that would lead to overturning the election. So as McEnany continued to blather on, Cavuto said, whoa, I just think we need to be very clear. She's charging that the other side is welcoming fraud and welcoming illegal voting. Unless she has more details to back that up, I can't in good conscience continue showing you this. What? Neil Cavuto, you've got a conscience? You work at Fox. He went on, I want to make sure that maybe they do have something to back this up. But that's an explosive charge to make, that the other side is effectively rigging and cheating. If she does bring proof of that, of course, we'll take you back. Well, the proof will come on Hannity and Laura Ingraham tonight. And that's where Fox has become really it's schizophrenic. I think that's the best way I can describe it. So, on the final day of the campaign, Trump wrapped things up by phoning in to Foxy Friends. And he raised the question and then answered his own question about what had changed the most for him since 2016. The answer was Fox. And, of course, he made the hosts of Foxy Friends squirm by attacking their network while he's on it. He said it's much different now. In the old days, they wouldn't put Sleepy Joe Biden on every time he opened his mouth. It's a much different operation, I'm just telling you. Well, that may be so. But Trump really believes that he owned Fox without buying it, and that they owe him, that he's entitled to that bootlicking coverage that they provided so often. And let's not forget that Joe Scarborough, who was not yet married to Mika Brzezinski, the two of them slobbered all over Trump in 2016. There were recordings made of their chatter between segments while the commercials were playing. And they allowed Trump to deflect topics. I don't want to talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, me. So when Fox News called Arizona for Biden on election night, about 11:20 p.m. Eastern time, the party in the White House grew silent. Trump erupted in anger, telling White House people to get that result changed. His chief of staff, Mark Meadows, now a super spreader, phoned Fox News' decision desk repeatedly. Hope Hicks, a darling of Trump's who had returned to the White House earlier this year after working at Fox Corporate, messaged Raj Shah, a former Trump White House staffer who she hired while she was at Fox. So they worked all the angles, but Fox wouldn't budge. And they put their decision desk guru, Arnon Mishkin, on the air so that he could defend his call. Now, we learned from this Washington Post report that Trump had squeezed Fox and asked them for a bulk discount advertising deal, and Fox said no. Now, he was asking them to break the law. And I know about this because I've worked on political campaigns as a media advisor. Under the law, there's what's called the lowest unit rate. And if you meet certain requirements, like the candidate shows up to say, I approve this message, then you get what's called the lowest unit rate for the time period that you are placing an ad in. And it applies to all qualified federal candidates. And Trump is probably oblivious to that law. But it just shows that he felt they owed him. We learned that in recent months he's been complaining on Twitter and in the White House to aides that Fox had turned on him. That impression was heightened when reports emerged that Rupert Murdoch was telling his pals that the president was going to lose. And as I pointed out at the time, it was bizarre because those Murdoch statements were issued at the same time that his New York Post published the attacks on Hunter Biden. By the way, those will be a feature of the incoming Senate investigative committees. We're not finished with Hunter or Ukraine or whatever he tried to do in China. And Trump took any perceived slight from Fox, especially personally, because he viewed it as my network. I give Fox these mega ratings. It's all me. Yeah, right, Don. That's what every narcissist would say. So, Brett Baier, the news anchor who is the lead at Fox, has repeatedly pushed back against claims of voter fraud leveled by Trump allies. When correspondent Eric Schon was asked Friday by host Dana Perino about Trump allegations that Republican poll watchers were being blocked in Philadelphia, Schon responded, "That's not true. It's not true. That's just not true." So, the final quote here, officials said Trump was in some ways angrier about Fox News on Wednesday than his loss. One ally said that when Trump called him on Wednesday, he expected him to complain about the results. Instead, Trump railed about Fox. He's got his priorities. Very well set, wouldn't you say? So by my count, the people in the president's corner are Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Kevin McCarthy. He's the number two, well, he's the top Republican in the House, and Crown Prince Jared, who apparently keep telling Trump to fight on. We can't let these libtards prevail. And it's interesting because the Washington Post quotes at length a guy who I worked on a Republican political campaign back in 2000. I was the media consultant for Tom Campbell, the moderate Republican, who got he won the primary to challenge Dianne Feinstein. And Bill Whalen was in the circle of Campbell advisors. And despite being at the Hoover Institution, Bill Whalen is still a rational human being. He said it would be a once-in-a-lifetime coincidence of events. In other words, Trump is going to lose. The president will run out of legal options and the election will go to Joe Biden. Eventually, there will be a Barry Goldwater moment. And he was referring to when Goldwater and a couple of other senators went to the White House in the summer of 74 to tell Richard Nixon that it was over. Bill Whalen said Trump will probably received the same message regarding support within his party. Until then, Biden will make daily policy announcements and appointments, and we will forget about all of this. One more from Whalen. The 2000 election stretched into mid-December before it was conceded, and today the Republic still stands. The only damage done by these kinds of challenges is in the short term, not the long term. So, Lindsey Graham told Trump not to concede. Chris Kobach, the discredited former Secretary of State from Kansas who ran that ugly interstate cross-check list. He didn't use the name cross-check, but he said, you know, there's very much a live legal controversy in multiple states. He pointed to Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Nevada, where Republicans have alleged that more than 3,000 voters who did not live in the state cast their ballots there. That last part is just about Nevada. He said, if anything, this latest election has once again raised the profile of the issue. It's a perennial problem. Yeah, right, Chris. And I was a little alarmed over the weekend because it was reported that Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito ordered Pennsylvania counties to comply with state guidance to keep late-arriving ballots separate, but he did not direct officials to stop counting ballots as Republicans requested. And because it appears, again, if Georgia does come in for Biden, that Pennsylvania would not be the state that delivers the critical number of electoral votes. And if that's the case, then I think that this is in the bag and beyond any efforts to recount votes, disqualify ballots. Now, one of the things I don't have any inkling about so far is how many absentee ballots have been rejected, and we may not know that for several weeks until elections are certified and we get more details. And Lindsey Graham has chipped in some cash to help the depleted coffers of the Trump campaign. And Trump is also out there squeezing his loyal supporters, who he has so much contempt for, demanding that they chip into this post-election contest. And the fine print says, and half of the money I'm squeezing out of you will go to retire my campaign debt. Because I'm a cheap ass who calls himself a billionaire. So, Lindsey is saying that mail balloting probably led to voting irregularities and fraud on a scale that swayed the election. And this is a central talking point. Lindsey Graham says that Fox News, he said it on Fox News, that the Trump campaign has found 15 dead voters in Pennsylvania who cast ballots. But the margin is 45,000. And 15 dead voters will not be able to kill that margin. There's also a report from a postal worker in Pennsylvania saying that his supervisors were backdating ballots so that those that were arriving late would count. But we don't have any evidence of that. And Rush Limbaugh, who I will be a little generous to because he's been busy getting treatment for cancer that appears to be killing him. And he hung on through the election, I think, hoping to experience the glorious re-election of his Trump. And so I got 7 minutes of Limbaugh this morning on my way to the secret studio. And he was sputtering about how mail-in ballots are bad. And this was really bizarre, because it's widely known, anybody who watched the hours of election coverage last week, that Pennsylvania law, set by its Republican-controlled legislature, prohibited the processing. You could not even open the envelopes of mail-in ballots until Election Day. And Rush was just all over that. You know, why didn't they start counting? They had them for weeks. And, you know, he pointed out that Florida did it. But those are Republican voter suppression and intervention tactics. And Limbaugh was misleading his listeners into believing that it was Democratic election officials who made the count slow and laborious. And he actually said this. It's obvious what they were doing. They had to see how many votes they needed before they could stop the counting. And he also was stoking anger with a caller. I mean, he actually asked the guy, "Are you angry?" And when he said yes, Limbaugh said good or something like that. And then the caller said, "Where's Bill Barr? Why isn't he busting up these criminal vote counting operations?" Well, the first part of the question is interesting. Bill Barr, who has been kissing ass and running interference for Trump ever since he was elevated to his second tour at the Justice Department. I haven't heard a peep out of Bill Barr. Trump went to Twitter today to dismiss the Secretary of Defense. He terminated him. Mark Esper will, I guess, hit the revolving door and go back to Raytheon, where he'll make 10 times as much money and be able to use his influence to sell more military gear to the Department of Defense. And we get another interim, another acting cabinet member. This is Christopher C. Miller, who since August has been director of the National Counterterrorism Center. And he was on the National Security Council before that, where he apparently impressed Trump that he can be counted on to do whatever dance Trump orders him to do. And Mark Esper, it's been known for weeks that in June, when he disagreed publicly with Trump about using the law to deploy military troops on the streets of the United States, the Insurrection Act, that's what I was looking for. He also quietly moved to take down Confederate names from military bases in the South, and to very cleverly ban the display of the Confederate flag on military facilities. He did it by listing all the flags that were approved and leaving out the Confederate flag. So, you know, Trump needed some vengeance. He needed a head on a pike, as Steve Bannon would say. And Mark Esper was the victim today. I imagine there'll be more. It's interesting because he really has it in for Christopher Wray, the guy he chose to run the FBI after he fired too tall Jim Comey. And I don't know if he'll fire Wray or just allow him to dangle and see what Biden does. One Trump loyalist is refusing to sign paperwork that would activate the transition plan and fund it for the Biden officials to get up and running, find out what's going on in each agency. It's a tradition that was pretty much spurned by Trump in 2016. His transition people either attended meetings and played with their phones or didn't attend the meetings. And so it was one of the weakest transitions in American history. But his loyalist, a woman named Emily Murphy, is the administrator at the General Services Administration, the GSA. And so far, she is refusing to sign the paperwork that would officially launch the transition and release about $10 million in funding that has been allocated for that effort. So every day I like to pause and thank the people who have been supporting my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast over the past 11 years. And I have made the decision at this point. It's subject to events that I can't predict. But if there is any significant effort to block Biden's ascent to the White House, I may revise this plan. But at this point, I'm planning to wind down the Daily News and Comment podcast before Thanksgiving. You can expect a series of exit interviews with some of the people who've been my favorites, who I've been talking to for many years. I've started to work on that now. I'm also going to release one or two podcasts with interviews with listeners like you, the people who have made this so worthwhile for me, because I can sit here at the secret studio and talk, but if you're not listening, what good is it? So I'm extremely grateful to all of you who've been there for me over the years and who have validated my work through your communications, your contributions to support the podcast. So after I end the daily series, that's when I'll be focusing on the interviews. And when I complete that, one of the things I plan to do over time is about once a week or so, I'm going to repost one of the interviews that I consider to be a classic from the PeterBCollins.com archives. And I want you to know the website will stay up and running. The archives will be there. You can access them. That's where you should drop in occasionally to see if I've decided to break silence or break wind and post an occasional commentary or interview. So I've got a couple of reminders for you. If you have been a subscriber as recently as October, I have your email. Now, if you canceled sometime before October, you had an old subscription, your contacts may no longer be in my database. So, if you've never subscribed, or if you had a subscription, but for whatever reason you stopped it, please send me an email and just put in the subject line, "Put me on your list." I'm going to create an alert list so that when I do break silence and post a podcast, you'll get an email alert with that information. And if you prefer a text message, indicate that in your email. I'll set up a separate list for people who want to get a text. And the other thing I ask is if you send me an email for any reason, could you please list two or three other podcasts that you listen to and enjoy? And, you know, they should be in the same general genre, but they don't have to be exactly news and politics, which is my beat. Many people have said, "Oh, Peter, you're going, I don't know what I'm going to do." And so I'd like to offer tips from listeners. And by the way, this will inform me. I don't have the time to listen to Michael Moore, to Matt Taibbi. And I do occasionally people say, "Hey, you got to check this out," and I'll listen to part of it. But with more time on my hands, I want to explore other points of view and other voices. So this will help inform me as well. And just one more reminder, please cancel your PayPal orders. I am not able to reach through PayPal and cancel your monthly subscription or your annual subscription. And I will be refunding any money that I collect after I stop the daily podcast and any annuals that sneak through. But just to protect yourself and your bank account and credit card, please make a note to cancel your PayPal orders to peterbcollins.com. And I've got my list in front of me here of people I want to thank today. Susan Gavet, we've been friends for a long time. Jim Garrison, Lamara Williams-Jones, let me turn the page here. Brian Massey, Ethan Knox, and the amazing Teresa Paris, Terry Paris. So I'm grateful to each and every one of you, and I thank you for your support over the years. So over the weekend, I was pleased to see that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez continued fighting for progressives in the internal struggle of the Democratic House contingent. She gave an interview to the New York Times that I'm going to quote from here. She was also on CNN yesterday, and she made some of the same points in both interviews. But one of the things she points out is in that call where Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, the one-term Democrat who used to work at the CIA and ran in a very Republican district and barely won again, she barely won in 2018, she blamed people for using socialism and defund the police. And it's because the Republicans used campaign commercials to lie to voters in Spanberger's district. And so instead of calling out the lies of Republicans, Spanberger says, we've got to shut up the progressives. So AOC is having none of it. She said, we learned from this election that progressive policies do not hurt candidates. Every single candidate that co-sponsored Medicare for All in a swing district kept their seat. We also know that co-sponsoring the Green New Deal was not a sinker. Mike Levin was an original co-sponsor of the legislation, and he kept his seat. I think it's going to be really important how the party deals with this internally and whether the party is going to be honest about doing a real postmortem and actually digging into why they lost. Because before we even had any data on a lot of these races, there was already finger-pointing that this was progressives' fault and that this was the fault of the movement for black lives. I've already started looking into the actual functioning of these campaigns. And I've been, the thing is, I've been unseating Democrats for 2 years. I've been defeating DCCC candidates for 2 years. That's how I got to Congress. That's how we elected Ayanna Pressley and Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush. And so we know about extreme vulnerabilities in how Democrats run campaigns. Some of this is criminal. It's malpractice. Connor Lamb, he's the conservadem from Pittsburgh, spent $2,000 on Facebook the week before the election. I don't think anybody who isn't on the internet in a real way in the year of our Lord 2020 and loses an election can blame anyone else when you're not even really on the internet. And I've looked through a lot of these campaigns that lost, and the fact of the matter is you're not spending $200,000 on Facebook with fundraising, persuasion, volunteer recruitment, get out the vote. You're not firing on all cylinders. And not a single one of these campaigns were firing on all cylinders. And then she responds to another question. These folks are pointing toward Republican messaging that they feel killed them, right? But why were you so vulnerable to that attack? If you're not door-knocking, not on the internet, your main points of reliance are TV and mail, then you're not running a campaign on all cylinders. I just don't see how anyone could be making ideological claims when they don't run a full-fledged campaign. Our party isn't even online, not in a real way that exhibits competence. And so, yeah, they were vulnerable to these messages because they weren't even on the media where these messages were most potent. Sure, you can point to the message, but they were sitting ducks. There's a reason Obama built an entire national campaign apparatus outside of the Democratic National Committee. And there's a reason that when he didn't activate or continue that, we lost House majorities. Because the party in and of itself does not have the core competencies, and no amount of money is going to fix that. AOC continues, if I lost my election and I went out and I said, this is moderates' fault, that is because you didn't let us have a floor vote on Medicare for All. And they opened the hood of my campaign and found out I only spent $5,000 on TV ads the week before the election, they would laugh. And that's what they look like right now, trying to blame the movement for black lives for their loss. Asked what surprised her from the election? The share of white support for Trump. There was that feeling of realizing what work we have to do. We need to do a lot of anti-racist deep canvassing in this country. Because if we keep losing white shares and just allowing Facebook to radicalize more and more elements of white voters and the white electorate, there's no amount of people of color and young people that can turn out to offset that. But the problem is, right now, I think a lot of Democratic strategy is to avoid actually working through this. Just try to avoid poking the bear. That's their argument with defunding police, right? To not agitate racial resentment. I don't think that is sustainable. There's a lot of magical thinking in Washington that this is just about the special people that kind of come down from on high. I need people to take these goggles off and realize how we can do things better. If you're the DCCC and you're hemorrhaging incumbent candidates to progressive insurgents, you would think that you may want to use some of those firms. But instead, we banned them. So the DCCC banned every single firm that is the best in the country at digital organizing. That's a very important criticism that she raised there. She went on to say, "It's really hard for us to turn out non-voters when they feel like nothing changes for them, when they feel like people don't see them or even acknowledge their turnout. If this party believes after 94% of Detroit went to Biden, after black organizers just doubled and tripled turnout in Georgia, after so many people organized Philadelphia, the signal from the Democratic Party is the John Kasichs won us this election?" So today, there were more tweets back and forth because John Kasich went out and said the Democrats have to make it clear to the far left that they almost cost Biden this election. So AOC responded, "You've heard this claim. Every single swing seat House Democrat who endorsed Medicare for All won re-election or is on track to win. Every single one." In another tweet, AOC quote tweeted Kasich's warning and asked, "Anyone saying this after immigrant organizers delivered Arizona, black grassroots flipped Georgia, Michigan going blue with reality-bending 94% Detroit margin, and Rashida Tlaib running up the margins in her district, and Trump publicly challenging Ilhan Omar in Minnesota?" Anybody who's saying this and losing isn't a serious person. So I really respect this young woman. I think she's got a real smart political set of instincts, and she's not a screamer, but she's a fighter. Meanwhile, as I mentioned last week, there are still three Democrats who are part of the 2018 flip in Orange County. Well, one's in the Central Valley, but two in Orange County, who are on what appears to be the losing end. Votes keep coming in, and the margins keep growing for their Republican opponents. And this would be Congressman Gil Cisneros, Harley Ruda over in Orange County on the coast, and T.J. Cox of Fresno. They were all behind on Election Day, and it has gotten worse since. Want to recommend a couple of pieces of commentary about this struggle between the progressive left and the centrists in the Democratic Party. James Downey in the Washington Post. A couple of quotes here. "A near majority of voters in swing districts supported the Green New Deal. 53% of Americans support Medicare for All. 70% support a public option. In exit polls, 57% of voters express support for Black Lives Matter. And in Florida, while moderate Democrats up and down the ticket fell flat, voters passed a minimum wage of $15 that the left has been pushing for years." And a little bit later, "It's the fault of a party that is far behind the times when it comes to campaigning online. During the George W. Bush presidency, Democrats dominated the digital space. But in 2020, sites like Facebook and YouTube absorb Americans' attention spans regardless of affiliation, and Democrats are still playing catch-up." Final quote here, "It is simply false to claim that standing up proudly for policies such as Medicare for All and a Green New Deal hasn't worked, when the truth is, it hasn't been tried. For decades, congressional Democrats have run every cycle with a moderate message, engineered by moderate, high-priced consultants. When this plan succeeds, the party establishment trumpets their wisdom. Yet when it more frequently fails, the leadership and moderates blame the progressives that they rejected the entire campaign. It's a head we win, tails you lose approach, and it's a farce. And my friend Norman Solomon at Common Dreams has a piece warning Biden not to try to cooperate with Mitch McConnell. He says, let's be clear. The extent to which Biden goes along with such a scenario of craven capitulation will be the extent to which he has shafted progressives before his presidency has even begun. And in Portland, the news of Joe Biden's elevation led to the arrest of three people who tagged and vandalized the Multnomah County Democrats' headquarters. And these appear to be true anarchists who basically don't support either party. Here's today's COVID-19 update compiled by Linda Lewis. We now have 10 million cases reported in the United States, and that's 106,000 new cases reported for Sunday, 237,000, almost 238 now, including 457 new deaths, which were listed on Sunday. And scientists announced today that trial results for Pfizer and BioNTech's coronavirus vaccine are exceeding expectations. The drug makers say the vaccine is more than 90% effective at preventing COVID-19 based on data from 94 people. Wow, that's a pretty small group of people. Anyway, we also don't know how long the immunization will last. That's one of the open questions about this. They do declare that there are no major side effects that have been reported so far. The stock market shot up by 4% on the announcement from Pfizer. They say that safety data will not be available till later this month. And I am very concerned about the rushing of this process. I hope this news is accurate. I hope it is effective and it doesn't have significant side effects. But the rush to produce this has led to a lot of cutting corners. And I am concerned. Because, of course, if they announce that they're going to inoculate people with the Pfizer vaccine, and it fails or it kills people, then not only will we be set back further by this pandemic, but people's confidence in a vaccine at all will be severely undermined. So Gregory Polin, virologist, vaccine researcher at the Mayo Clinic, they are really encouraging, but they are the earliest of results possible. And almost former Vice President Mike Pence tweeted, huge news, thanks to the public-private partnership forged by President Trump, Pfizer announced its coronavirus vaccine trial is effective. Well, Ivanka tweeted something similar. But Vanity Fair reports that Katherine Janssen, a senior VP and head of vaccine research at Pfizer, said, we were never a part of the warp speed. We have never taken any money from the U.S. government or from anyone. And as the Washington Post reports, the drug maker agreed to partner with the government to distribute it. But the developmental efforts have had nothing to do with the Trump administration. But taking credit for things you're not responsible for, that is a common thread. So the Biden team announced a public health coronavirus study group that will include Rick Bright, the whistleblower from the Trump administration who alleged that his early warnings about the pandemic were ignored and ultimately led to his removal. There'll be 13 people on this task force. And it includes the former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, former FDA Commissioner David Kessler, Yale University's Marcella Nunez-Smith, Dr. Luciana Borio, a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Oh, that's great. And Dr. Zeke Emanuel, former Obama health advisor and the brother of Rahm. The Department of Defense has deployed three U.S. Air Force medical specialty teams to El Paso to help officials cope with a surge in coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. It's 20 military medical providers with each of the three teams. El Paso has confirmed almost 60,000 cases and 657 deaths. And an El Paso judge issued a stay-at-home order on October 29th, and it does appear to be in effect locally. Utah's Governor Gary Herbert declared a state of emergency Sunday night to relieve pressure on overcrowded hospitals and to save lives, instituting a statewide mask mandate for the foreseeable future. Now, he had resisted this as long as he could, but officials say that Utah's situation is dire and unsustainable, with hospitals struggling to cope. And we learned on Friday that a number of White House officials, including the Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, and now we learn David Bossi, the high-profile Republican lawyer who was hired to run the post-election battle, it appears that they picked up the Rona at the White House victory party on election night. Also, Cabinet Secretary, the Director of HUD, Ben Carson, has tested positive, and he told a friend that he's feeling pretty bad over the last couple of days. He went to Walter Reed to take a test and was declared positive. And all this, the common thread is that these are people who were gathered in the East Room Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. And the only cabinet official who was known to be wearing a mask was Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And earlier on Election Day, Mark Meadows had joined the president to visit his campaign headquarters in Virginia. He did not wear a mask, and he may be at the center of the transmission of the virus through the recent White House outbreak here. I put up a link in the show file for this podcast, and I highly recommend the investigative report from Whitney Webb. And you'll remember Whitney was the great reporter who dug into Jeffrey Epstein and his convoluted ties to many deep state and other entities. Well, today she's published a piece. Actually, it's almost a month old. It was published on October 6th. And she dug into the strange arrangements around Operation Warp Speed. Now, it's got a $10 billion budget to distribute vaccines in the United States. But there are many unusual aspects of this. One is that the military is deeply involved. Number two, a company called Advanced Technology International, ATI, which is primarily a defense contractor, is basically running this operation. And it appears that that is a way of avoiding having the government do it directly, which would lead to all kinds of federal contracting requirements and dreaded regulatory oversight. So the contracts awarded through ATI so far total $6 billion, and Pfizer has a piece of that. The operation is described as highly secretive, dominated by military personnel, most of whom have no experience in healthcare or vaccines. A decision to use a non-government intermediary like ATI to issue the vaccine contracts allows it to bypass the regulatory oversight and transparency of traditional federal contracting mechanisms. So this report broke on NPR, and we haven't seen that much coverage of it. But I think particularly if you're a skeptic like me, you'll want to take a look at this article. And as I mentioned, there is a link in the show file for today's podcast at peterbcollins.com. The governor of New York has announced the National Guard will be deployed to New York airports to welcome visitors and to make sure that they've had a coronavirus test within the preceding 48 hours. Cuomo warned you should not land if you do not have proof of a negative test on landing. Also, in New York State and in New York City. They are ramping up certain restrictions, and this could lead to, a potential shutdown like we saw in the spring. But so far, they're taking incremental steps, and the area that was in the red zone, where many Jewish people were complaining, they felt the restrictions were too targeted to them, those have been eased in Brooklyn, while at the same time in the far western portions of New York State, Erie, Monroe, and Onondaga counties will face greater restrictions. In Bolivia, on the heels of the election that overturned the coup last November, the man who was ejected from office and sent into exile, Evo Morales, made his return to Bolivia, entering on the southern border. He had been exiling in Argentina. And the president of Argentina, Alberto Fernandez, escorted Morales to the border crossing with a shout-out of Viva Bolivia, Viva Latin America. And I consider that to be good news. And we say farewell first to Bones Hillman. He was the longtime bass player for Midnight Oil, one of my favorite Australian bands. He died in Milwaukee of cancer at the age of 62 on Saturday. And not only was he a great bass player, and that band has a really powerful rhythm section, he also provided the backup vocals that blended so beautifully with lead singer Peter Garrett. And I have to tell you that I'm really going to miss Alex Trebek. Almost every evening during dinner, Kathy and I, who are empty nesters, turn off the politics that I'm so obsessed with, and she's not quite as obsessed as I am, and we spend the 28 minutes watching Jeopardy. And we enjoy it. We, either praise or ridicule the contestants. We mimic Alex's perfect pronunciation and enunciation. And it's just a lot of fun to test your brain and sometimes score better than the contestants do. Well, we've known for a year and a half that Alex was fighting pancreatic cancer, and it took him on Sunday at the age of 80. And we've learned that they recorded enough episodes of the show that they will play through Christmas Day. The way they've produced the show, Alex only had to work 46 days a year. They would do a week's worth of shows in a day. And so that's why there are episodes that are already in the can through Christmas Day. But in one of the shows during the, they don't say explicitly, but very close to Christmas, Alex opened the show with an emotional speech about togetherness. And it appears that they may edit that into some of the earlier shows before we get to Christmas. But the producer, whose name is, Mike Richards, he said, Alex was in pain and we knew it. He'd had surgery. I couldn't believe he was already back from the surgery that he'd had just 2 weeks before that. I had chills the entire day. The first show of that final week, which is unbelievably the week of Christmas, he gives a speech talking about togetherness, how important family is, and it will resonate even more now. It was so beautiful that we were all emotional, we were all in tears, and all started clapping. And then he said, okay, now let's play Jeopardy. Alex Trebek, happy trails to you. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.